Well, good morning. Hope everybody had a great 4th of July. Did you? I would expect much more applause for the kind of weather that this city has had over the last week. What a great thing. Yeah, absolutely. I actually have been in town all week. I spoke here last Sunday and had a great time doing so. And of course, I'm here this weekend, and so I actually flew out my entire family so we could spend the week together. We went up to Bellingham. I do regret it because after last weekend services, I had my family with me the entire time, Saturday and Sunday. My 7-year-old son, Jaden, looks at me and says, "Dad, I like their church way more than I like ours." And so, of course, I had to ask him why, and he knew exactly why. He said, because they give pizza and donuts. He came on Saturday for the pizza and donuts on Sunday morning. So there you go. That's your reputation through the eyes of a 7-year-old. He didn't talk about your prayer, didn't talk about your love for Jesus, didn't talk about your worship, but he likes the fact you give away free things, all right? So be ashamed of yourselves. Be really ashamed. Guys, we started the series a couple weeks ago called God at the Movies. And, of course, every week, we're just taking different films from different eras, different genres, and we're pulling from them spiritual truths that we can apply to our life. Now, my 14-year-old daughter said to me this week, "Dad, I promise I'll pay close attention if you will speak off of Justin Bieber's documentary, Never Say Never." But the truth is, I do not have enough Prozac to get me through 15 minutes of his music, much less a documentary, so we're not going to do that, I promise you. We are, for you Steve Carell fans, going to talk out of a movie that he was in called Dan in Real Life. And just a really obscure fact, Dan in Real Life sold more tickets than the Titanic and the Harry Potter movies combined. No, that's a total lie. I don't think this thing sold 10 tickets, right? But no worries if you didn't see it, which is about 99% of us, right? I actually did watch it, and the reason we're using it as a launching pad is because the premise of the movie is something we can all relate to. Dan, played by Steve Carell in the movie, is a widower and a father of 3 lovely girls. And what makes the movie so relatable and applicable to us is that his job is writing a parenting advice column for a local newspaper, but yet he himself isn't a good father. He has the reputation of being a good dad just because of his articles, but he's got this really awkward relationship with his own kids. And it's not because he wants that. He wants to be an amazing dad. It's just there's so many distractions in his life. He's got his career, which is very distracting. He's got caught up in this love triangle. You saw a little bit of that a few minutes ago. That's distracting him. His insecurities distract him. And so even though he wants to be this amazing dad, the truth is, in reality, he has this tension going on between what he knows to do, because he's got all the knowledge, he's got the reputation of being this amazing writer on parenting, and this tension between knowing what to do and actually doing it. And I love that because it's a tension we all face. Right? All of us in our life right now could identify a couple areas for sure that we're like, man, I aspire to be great in this area. I aspire to be a great dad, a great husband, a great wife, a great employee, a great employer. I have in my mind that I would like to be this encourager to other people. I want to be this person who's known for character. We could just fill in the blank of all the things in life we aspire to, but we all know the tension between knowing what to do and actually doing it is very tense. And the reason that the tension exists is because there's so many distractions in life. I mean, I said to my wife this last week, I said, "Can I just tell you how frustrating it is being a pastor sometimes?" I said, because I realize all the talks that we give, it's like not even possible to live it all out. Right? Let's be an amazing dad, an amazing parent, and be at your kids' ball games, but be a great employer and give extra effort over at work and make sure you forgive everyone who hurts you. And I said, just sometimes it gets overwhelming. I get lost in it all and say, man, can anybody even do half of this stuff? And the true answer is no, we can't. That's why we need Jesus. He's perfect and we're not. We get that. But I think one of the reasons it's so difficult to move forward in any area of our life is there's just so much going on. There's busyness and stress and distractions taking place. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to look at a key verse in the Bible that speaks into the issue of distractions. And typically when I give a talk, I like to go through 10, maybe 15 verses, sometimes look at an entire story and break it down verse by verse. But we're not going to do that today. We're just going to look at one key Bible verse. And I know that sounds really unspiritual, and if Pastor Ben was here, he'd give a lot more verses. That would bother me, but a church that's known for giving away pizza and donuts, I'm not real bothered about looking unspiritual. We're actually going to look at this one key Bible verse. And the reason we're going to do it is because some people would refer to the verse we're going to look at as a life verse. Some you can build your life on, very much like a life mantra. Right? A life mantra is what? A phrase? It's a saying, it's a philosophy that someone builds their life on. If you're not familiar with a life mantra is, once I start quoting some to you, you'll recognize it. My Google search, some of the more popular ones. Here we go. Here's a life mantra. Commitment means staying loyal to what you said you were going to do long after the mood you set it in has left you. Ooh, that's a good mantra for someone who wants to be a person of commitment. You just say, that's what I'm going to build my life on. Here's another one. Never get so busy making a living that you forget to make a life. That's good. Here's another one. It's better to have loved and lost than to never have loved at all. That's stupid. Seriously, whoever came up with that, never had a girl that they loved in the ninth grade look at them after they opened their heart and their soul to them and shared their life goals and future plans with and say, let's just be friends. It's not you, it's me. Another friend who adopted as their life mantra, and you've probably heard this before, eat dessert first because life is uncertain. And sadly, that friend of mine ended up passing away. And so at her funeral, as a way of honoring her, at the dinner following, we actually ate dessert first because we wanted to make a memory in her honor. And so the reason anybody would have a life mantra, the reason anybody would choose a life verse is to say, hey, I don't want to waste my life. I want to make sure my life has meaning and that it counts and it matters. Nobody just wants to sit around doing nothing. Maybe you are familiar with the story of Larry Walters. Larry was a 33-year-old truck driver living in the Los Angeles area in the early 1980s. And he had a pretty routine life. Every day, Larry would come home. He'd go in the backyard, sit in his lawn chair, get out a six-pack, start to drink, and read the newspaper. It was just day after day after day. And he kind of got fed up with the routine and the boringness of it. He just kept trying to think, how can I make my life a little bit more exciting? Now, he was actually, in his mind, he wanted to, one of the things he aspired to is he wanted to be a pilot. But he had poor eyesight, and so that kept him from doing it. So he kept still thinking, how can I make my life exciting? So he decided he was going to pilot himself. And the way he was going to do this is a crazy idea he came up with. He was going to attach some weather balloons to the lawn chair he sat in every day. So true story, he goes to an army surplus store, buys 45 weather balloons, has some friends come over, they fill them up with helium, and they attach it to his lawn chair. And then he puts like some weights on the bottom of the lawn chair to try to even this stuff out. And he has ropes that are holding it down. And his goal is to go a couple hundred feet into the air. And so before he gets out there, he goes, makes a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. He grabs a six pack and he grabs a BB gun. Because his thing is, if I go more than a couple hundred feet, I'm going to shoot out a couple of these helium balloons or these weather balloons. And I'll just start descending back to Earth. Well, he gets it all together. He has his friends cut the rope. And from the moment that rope is cut, everything goes wrong. He doesn't shoot up a couple hundred feet slowly and 45 weather balloons. He shoots up to 15,000 feet in the air in his lawn chair that has some sandbags at the bottom of it. He is so terrified that he cannot take his hands off of the arms of the chair to actually start shooting it down. But he's ended up there for 14 hours. And so after a number of hours, he says, I've got to do something about this. His heart's racing. He's scared out of his mind. He does get the gun up, and he shoots down a couple, which helps just a little bit. But then he's just shaking so much, he drops the gun. So he's stuck up there. He is sighted by a DC-10 airline pilot who radios down to the control tower. There's a man up here in his lawn chair. And so they have to shut down a part of the LA airport. They've got to try to figure out what to do. They get a helicopter out. Nothing's working. But finally, they do get a rope to him, and they start pulling him down to Earth. Eventually, they do get him back down. And of course, there's the media waiting for him. And the first thing they do is they throw a microphone in his face and said, what were you thinking? And his only response is, well, a man can't just sit around. That was it. What a crazy story. But I love that story because it's something we all relate to, right? None of us want to get to the end of our life, whether that's our 20s, our 30s, our 50s, our 80s, our 90s. None of us want to get to the end of our life and say, yep, every day just went through the same routine, same motions, went to work, came home. On the weekends, we'd go to the lake house. In the summers, we'd take vacation. None of us just want to feel like our life is just this cycle of meaninglessness. And yet, if we're honest, right, if we get past the churchy answers and the spiritual, here's the thing to say. I think a lot of us, even with God being such a big part of our life would say, it feels meaningless sometimes. It feels purposeless. It feels like it's lacking purpose. Right? I think if we're honest, there are times we just go through seasons of life and say, it feels like I'm going nowhere. But at the end of the day, none of us want to waste our life. None of us want to feel like we're just sitting around. And so we're going to look into this story today that really speaks into this whole idea of purpose and meaning and making sure that we're not just taken away by the little distractions in life. And the story we're going to look at is in the book of Nehemiah. All right? Any guesses as to who the main character in this story is going to be, the main person? Nehemiah, yeah. Even the public school kids got this one. All right. Good, 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 good. All right, so Nehemiah. That's the person in the story. Now, a couple things you're going to want to know about Nehemiah. One of the things is Nehemiah was not a paid religious professional. Right? He didn't go to Bible college or seminary. He didn't work for a church. He wasn't a pastor or a priest. He didn't have a nice fancy hat. And the reason I tell you that is because sometimes we have this stereotype that if God's going to use someone, they got to work for a church. But then you read through the Bible and God just seemed to use anybody whose hearts were open to being used by him. He'd use their talents, their personalities. And so Nehemiah is one of these guys. He wasn't a church person in regards to how we pay, you know, how some people work for a church. He actually worked for a king. His job was he was a cupbearer. Boring, right? It's like, dude, do something significant with your life. Like, be a country singer. Make a difference. But he was a cupbearer. And even though it sounds lame, it was actually kind of a Jack Bauer type of job because what that meant was he would drink wine before the king would drink it just to make sure it wasn't poisoned. And of course, if it was poisoned, it was Nehemiah losing his life, not the king. So that's something worth knowing. Another thing worth knowing about Nehemiah is he's one of the greatest leaders in all the Bible. So if you're here today and you're like, I don't believe any of this God stuff and I'm not into this Jesus stuff. I'm here because my girlfriend said she'd take me out to lunch afterwards and she'd pay for it. I'm not telling you that they're giving away hamburgers afterwards, right? It's worth knowing this, that even if you don't believe the Bible, it's sometimes worth reading just for cool stories like this. Nehemiah is one of the greatest leaders in the Bible, and you can read it. It's a fascinating study on leadership. Another thing worth knowing about Nehemiah and his life is he loved to journal. At the end of the day, he'd sit there and write down and thoughts, some of the things that happened. And it's the book of Nehemiah is really just pages out of his journal. So that's a pretty cool thing worth knowing. I know sometimes there's a disconnect, right? We live in 2013. Nobody journals. Nobody has a diary. Yeah, you do. It's called Facebook. All right? We know what you ate. We know your pictures of your vacation. Hey, I'm into it too. And thankfully, Nehemiah's journal, a lot more depth than our Facebook statuses because we learn a lot about the history of Israel, or specifically the city of Jerusalem through his journal. One of the things we learned is 2,500 years ago, the city of Jerusalem's in complete disrepair. I mean, it is messed up. The walls surrounding the city have been destroyed. The place of worship has been demolished. Most of the people living in the city have fled. And it's just a really, really sad time in the history of the Jews. And so what happens is God puts it on the heart of this guy named Nehemiah, who himself was a Jew, to relocate from where he was to the city of Jerusalem so that he could lead the charge in rebuilding the walls and getting the place of worship back up and running and really restoring some pride and some dignity to the people who lived there, to the Jews. And not only does God put it on Nehemiah's heart, he miraculously makes a way for it to take place. He provides him with the resources he needs. More importantly, gives him the approval, favor with the king. And so he has the king's approval. And the king's behind the whole thing. I mean, just a pretty cool deal. And so what happens is Nehemiah moves to the city of Jerusalem. And he's walking around right when he gets there. And he's just heartbroken. He's just heartbroken by what he sees. One of the things that breaks his heart is the walls of the city have been destroyed. Now, these aren't walls around the entire city of ancient Jerusalem, but it's a decent portion of the city. They've been destroyed for 141 years. It just breaks his heart because those walls represented safety and security. The gates that were attached to those walls, they've been removed. It represents protection. And because those gates weren't there, because the walls weren't there, it was a very, very dangerous place to live because warlords surrounded the region. Mean people, like the people of Monroe, right? They would come in and they would take whatever they wanted. They would go into the city of Jerusalem. They'd take harvest from people. They'd take their resources. It was like a stomping ground to anybody who wanted to abuse the people. So there's no national pride, no sense that God's with us. They've long forgotten the history of how God's been faithful in the past. You've got all of those things taking place. And Nehemiah walks into that setting and he just starts meeting with people and he starts hearing their stories and his heart breaks more and more. And he finally comes to the conclusion. He said, there is a lot to get done here. The economy needs to be propped up. Leaders need to be put in place. Systems and structures need to be established. Like, we have a lot of stuff that needs to take place. But he said, it's overwhelming. And so if I don't do anything else while I'm here, here's the task I need to do. I need to get the walls rebuilt. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that needs to take place, but I just need to focus on something. And so I'm going to focus on the walls. Because if I can help lead the charge in getting the walls rebuilt, here's what's going to happen. The city's going to feel safe again. There's going to be a sense of pride for the nation again. There's going to be a sense of security for the people again. It's going to be protection against the enemies. And so Nehemiah calls together the people living in the city of Jerusalem. Again, most of the people have left, but the people who are there, some of the people even in the surrounding regions he gets on his side, he gets them together, and he casts this amazingly compelling vision. Very fascinating read. And basically, as he casts this vision, here's what he says. He goes, we've got a problem on our hands. Here's the problem. The walls have been down for 141 years. This city has no protection. We've got to do something about it. So here's the problem. And then he goes into, here's the solution. Here's why we have to do something about it. And here's why we have to do something about it right now. Here's the problem, here's the solution, here's why we have to do something about it, and here's why we have to do something about it right now. And the people get behind them. They rally together. They say, hoorah, let's do this thing. A very, very exciting time. Now I'm just going to pause here. Just take a time out. Because I want to apply this to our own lives. Right now, as you look at your life, I can guarantee you, just like my life, we can identify a number of areas in our life where the walls have kind of been destroyed. Things in our life that aren't looking good. Maybe it's our financial situation. Maybe it's our marriage. Maybe it's a relationship with our kids. Maybe it's a friendship that's been broken for too long with someone that you actually do care about. Maybe it's your spiritual life. You just feel like, hey, I've been at a dead end for a long, long time. As you look at your life and you identify a couple areas that you say, hey, this needs to be fixed. It's sat dormant for too long. I want you to ask yourself a critical question. Here it is. What is one thing in my life that's really worth focusing on right now? What's one thing in my life that's really worth focusing on right now? I know. You say, well, Dave, I got five things. I've got six things. If you saw my life, listen, Pastor Ben's probably got 20 things, all right? We all have a bunch of things that we know we need to work on, that we need to improve. It's overwhelming. So what's one thing? Nehemiah looks at a situation. He says, we need the economy. We need this up. We need this fixed. We need this system. I can't do it all. So what is one thing right now that if you said for the next 6 months, listen, we're halfway through 2013. We've got 6 months left. What if for the rest of the year we just said, okay, this is it. I'm sick and tired of having the same excuses. Oh, I got sidetracked. I got bored. I got overwhelmed. What if for the next 6 months we just said, this is what I'm going to do? What is one thing super, super important that if you could fast forward to the end of the year and it's done and it's finished or you've made serious progress, you'd say, I'm a different person because of it. What's the wall in disrepair in your life? Maybe it's a habit that you need to quit. That if you could push a magic button and somehow be transported to the end of this year and the habit was gone, you'd be a different person. You'd say, man, life is so different. Maybe it's a goal you need to accomplish. Maybe it's a project you need to complete that you've just let sit for too long. And you talk about, oh yeah, someday, someday, someday. And now it's been years. Maybe it's a relationship that needs to be restored. You've had a break in a relationship with someone you love and care about, and your pride or maybe just the awkwardness of emotions have kept you from really working toward resolution and healing in that relationship. It's just sat dormant for too long. It's like, man, if I just spent the next 6 months caring and trying to nurture and heal that relationship, it could be a game changer. Or maybe the opposite. Maybe it's a relationship you're in, a dating relationship, a relationship with some friends that you know is toxic. It's not healthy. And the best thing you could do is end that relationship. And the only thing that's kept you from ending that relationship is the emotional shrapnel that you're going to feel. The emotional shrapnel that you want nothing to do with. And so you just kind of run from it and you just avoid it. But you know it'd be healthy to end it. Maybe you find yourself drowning in debt. And every time you hear it talking money and finances, you're like, oh, I need to do that. I need to. Every time you hear Dave Ramsey on the radio or some debt consolidation commercial, you're like, yes, I need to. And you start to make progress. But the busyness of life, the distractions in life, the stress of life just gets you and you kind of give up. But you know that if you could just begin to focus on it, maybe 6 months isn't enough. Maybe you say, Dave, I'm going to need a couple years to get things back in order. But I know if I could do it, it would bring massive and positive change to my life. What's the wall in your life? For Nehemiah, it's actually the walls surrounding a good part of the city of ancient Jerusalem. And so he casts this compelling vision. He gets the workforce together. And immediately as they begin making progress, the surrounding regions start feeling threatened. They start feeling a little defensive. Because as they see these walls going up, they're saying, uh-oh, this is going to hurt our economy. Because right now we can take whatever we want. At least we can buy and sell with them, right? This certainly hurts our freedom because right now we just go and if we want something, we just do it and there's really no consequences because they don't have a lot of good structure set up to dealing with crime. And so they were really, really threatened. They're saying, what happens if the walls get put up and what happens if the gates get put on? They're going to be a force to be reckoned with. I mean, nobody's going to want to mess with them. Hey, they may even put together their own army. And so they get defensive, they feel threatened, and they start to form an opposition. And the leader of the opposition ends up being a guy by the name of Sanballat. And Sanballat decides he's going to make it his job to lead this opposition in distracting and discouraging and defeating Nehemiah and the Jews who are rebuilding these walls. Well, as many problems as they create, this opposition, as hard as they work to just make it a very, very terrible time for Nehemiah and the Jews, the walls start getting built. And they keep going higher and higher and higher. And finally, the project's almost done. The walls are almost complete. The gates are almost put on. I mean, it's like, uh-oh, our strategy didn't work. And so Sanballat says, I got to change my strategy. And so the strategy that he decides to come up with is he says, I'm going to distract Nehemiah from the wall by getting him away from the city of Jerusalem. I'm going to get him outside of the city. Because if I could get him outside of the city of Jerusalem and meet with him there, I could get a posse together and we could kill him. And if we kill him, I guarantee you the project's going to end because he's the leader. And everybody's going to get discouraged. Everybody's going to throw in the towel. I mean, it sat dormant, those walls, for 141 years. Let's just finish Nehemiah off. And so in Nehemiah chapter 6, we find this very interesting encounter between Nehemiah and Sanballat. And it's in the midst of that encounter that we bump up against this verse that can absolutely be life-changing if it becomes a foundational verse and a motivational factor for our life. And what happens is Sanballat writes Nehemiah a letter and he sends one of his messengers. He says, go find Nehemiah and give him this letter. So the messenger goes in the city of Jerusalem. He's looking around. He's asking around. He finally sees Nehemiah up on a ladder. He shakes the ladder. Nehemiah, I got to talk to you. Nehemiah comes down. He says, here, I got a letter for you. It's from Sanballat. Nehemiah opens it to my dearest Nehemiah. Hugs and kisses. All right, your friend Sanballat. Here's the deal. I'd like to meet with you. Let's do breakfast together. Let's do lunch together. They just built a new In-N-Out out here. Come on, get out here. Let's do this thing. And Nehemiah reads his letter. And he doesn't know all the reasons that Sanballat wants to meet with him, but he does know this. I've got a project going on. I don't have all the time in the world. I've got to focus myself. If I get away from this wall, it's not going to be completed in the time period we just need to get this completed. And so Nehemiah sends his own messenger back to Sanballat, and that's the verse that we are going to look at for the rest of the time we have together. Here it is, Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 3. So I, Nehemiah, sent messengers to them saying, I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. I know, anticlimactic, right? It's like, oh, really? That's the verse? Translation. He says, listen, meeting with Sanballat may be a good thing, but I'm doing a great thing. He says, meeting with Sanballat may be worth my time. I don't know, but here's what I do know. I'm leading a crew of people, and I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. I don't have time for that. I've got to finish this project. And again, the reason this is so applicable to us is all of us can think of those areas in our life that we started strong, that we know we've been needing to work on. That we don't even need to pray about it. It's just there. We know. But it's so easy to throw in the towel. It's so easy to get sidetracked. It's so easy to get distracted. But if our life motto would become, you know what? I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down. I want to do that. I know it's a good thing and it's a fun thing and everybody's doing that right now. But here's what I know. I'm spending my efforts and my energy on this. I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down. The difference it could make. It's huge. Now, the opposition against Nehemiah was strong. It wasn't like Sanballat got the letter from the messengers and said, I'm doing great work and I cannot come down. Oh, okay, we'll stop bothering them. No, they keep going at it. He keeps sending messengers. Come on, Nehemiah. He keeps coming up with all these elaborate stories to get him distracted and to get him outside the city so they could kill Nehemiah. And Nehemiah must be very insightful because every single time his response is the exact same. He never changed it. Every single time he sent back the exact same message. I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. What if we did that in our marriage? If your marriage is on the brink of divorce or separation? What if you just said, you know what? I've been stubborn too long. I haven't sought out counseling. I haven't sought out godly wisdom. I haven't put myself in a growth group with other married couples. I'm going to swallow every bit of pride. This stinks. I don't want to do it. Everything in my emotion says, no, no, no. But you know what I'm going to do for the next 6 months or for the next year? I'm going to make my marriage my project. And I'm going to say to all these other distractions, good things in my life, all my friends who want to hang out, all that, not maybe every time, but I'm going to say over and over and over, in my mind, in my heart, I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down. This is my focus. If you're an employer and you just have awkwardness with your employees and you just come across as overbearing and you just have not learned to really lead in an inspirational way, you lead by maybe intimidation or fear. What if you just said, I can't lead like this the rest of my life. I want to actually like the people I work with and them to like me, and I understand that there's going to be some sort of separation there, but what if I just said, I'm going to learn how to be a great leader and I'm going to do a great work. And all the things that are going to distract, I'm just going to say, I'm not going to come down from the wall until it's done, until I finally learn. As a child, maybe you're just having these serious rebellious issues against your parents. Maybe you're still in college and you're rebelling. Maybe you're even in your 30s and you still have to sin against your parents. What if you just said, you know what? My parents, in some ways, find ways to irritate me and they find ways to drive me nuts, but I'm their child and I'm going to learn how to be a better kid. I'm going to learn how to respect them even when it's difficult. And there's a lot of things I've changed about my parents, but here's what I want to do. I want to be a better kid for them. And so I'm going to focus my efforts on figuring out how to do that. And I'm going to say, I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down. And folks, the moment you decide to do that, you're going to encounter distractions because there's distractions everywhere. And sometimes the distractions are innocent and they're good. Like they're opportunities that come our way and they're great opportunities. You've been praying and hoping for an opportunity like that. But if you really evaluate it, there are opportunities, not every opportunity, but there are opportunities that look good and are amazing, and they would be, except for they'll take you away from what you're supposed to be doing right now. They'll kill the time you have with your kids, and you know it, but you're like, oh, but this is such a great opportunity, but it'll get you down from the wall, right? Discouragement becomes a distraction. I mean, how many times in life do we say, this is what I'm going for, this is my goal this year, I'm moving toward, and you just get to the year, and you just get tired and discouraged. Tired, exhaustion, that becomes a distraction, right? I guarantee you, Nehemiah at certain points said, I'm done, man. This wall, I've been on here for 10 days, 15 days, 20 days. I'm tired. I want to come down, have a donut. I want to come down, watch some ultimate fighting, do something fun, right? But the problem is, if he would have come down, it would have been very, very costly. If he would have went and actually met with Sanballat and allowed that to be a distraction, he probably didn't realize it, but they would have taken his life. It would have cost him everything. I don't want to be overly dramatic today, but there are distractions in our life that are very, very costly. Period. There are. And you could look back in your life, as I could mine, and see the distractions that kept us away from doing the great things. And we say, man, we paid a big price for it. 40 years ago, some of you are going to remember this. Dark December night, Eastern Airlines Flight 401 crashed into the Florida Everglades, killing over 100 people on board. One of the worst tragedies and most casualties in an airplane crash in U.S. history. This is right up there toward the top. And what's interesting is in the investigation that followed afterwards onto why this plane crashed, there was really no common sense reason for it to happen. All the mechanical parts of the plane were working properly. Everything seemed to be functioning just right. They were literally 20 miles away from their destination in Miami. But as they continued their investigation, they heard the voice recordings and all that type of stuff. They realized that in the plane's final descent, as the pilots put out the landing gear, the green light that was supposed to illuminate in the plane, alerting them to the fact the landing gear had descended properly, did not come on. And so the pilots and the crew put all their attention on figuring out what was wrong with the light or what was wrong with the landing gear. And they put this plane into the circling motion above the Everglades, and everybody's so distracted with the light and with the landing gear that nobody realized the plane was descending toward the Everglades. And sure enough, the moment somebody did realize, oh, something's wrong, the autopilot had disengaged, it was too late. And so they crashed, over 100 people were killed. And then, like I said earlier, everything was working properly. As a matter of fact, the landing gear had descended properly. The only thing wrong in the entire plane was a 20-cent light bulb had burned out, which explained why the green light didn't illuminate. And And yet that green light became a distraction that set off the series of events that people lost their lives. Now, again, I'm not trying to be overly dramatic, but I am saying that in life, when we've got a purpose, we got to focus, we got to get something done, it's the little things that tend to pull us away that can be very, very costly for us. Let me throw out that marriage thing again. If you're in the season of your marriage where that's what you need to focus on, it's the little things that could keep that marriage from healing. If you're in a critical season with your kids, and sometimes we are and don't even realize it, and you just get so distracted with friends and hanging out and doing your thing, and you're just tired every day you come home from work, and you just want to veg out, and they don't get the attention they need, it can cost you in a big, big way, a price that you don't want to pay. Financially, if you don't give attention, maybe. Every one of us are different. We all have our different stories. But if you don't give attention, maybe in your current situation, it's going to be very, very, very costly. And so the question is, what do you need to focus on right now? What is it? For some of you, the most spiritual thing you can do in 2013 for the next 6 months is focus on your health. That's it. And I know that doesn't sound real godly, except for if you're not taking care of your health, you're not going to be as effective with your family or as an employee or whatever your situation is as you could be. And I was very open last week, right? That's what I'm focusing on this year, my health. Having battled depression now for 6 months, started seeing the therapist, started exercising, started eating healthy, started taking the medication, all those type of things. Guess what? I need to do that to be a better husband, to be a better dad, to be a better pastor, to give the attention to the people I need. And so for me, that's my issue in 2013. I just said, I got to get healthy again. What's your issue? Maybe it is a spiritual issue. Maybe you've said for way too long, oh, I just don't know how to pray, that's why I don't pray. I'm just not good at it. You can become good at it if you make it a focus. You just say, I don't care. I'm going to do this, and all the distractions, and whether it's tiredness or just things going on, busy, I'm doing a great work, and I can't come down. I got to learn how to be a person of prayer. Or maybe it's someone who says, I don't read the Bible because I don't really understand it. Well, we're living in an era, in a time period of history where we have many, many resources to learn how to study the Bible. What if you just said for the next 6 months, yeah, there's a lot of things in my life I need to work on. For the next 6 months, I'm going to learn how to study and read the Bible. And I'm going to say, every time I don't feel like doing it, every time I feel like throwing in the towel, I'm doing a great work. And I cannot come down. Others of you, your kids, you know, they're 3, 4, 5 years old. It's hard because you don't know how to communicate with them. You're used to working with technology all day long. You're not used to talking to kids about whatever the thing of the day is, right? I know it's not I love you, you love me anymore with Barney, but whatever that is, right? It's like you don't know how to communicate. It's just like, hi, ribbit, ribbit, I'm a frog. It's like, I'm lost. But maybe, because they're so impressionable, maybe you're going to decide, this is my season with my kids. At this age, as difficult as it is, I'm doing a great work and I can't come down. And yes, there's 100 other things I want to do, but this is it. This is my main focus. Or maybe your kids are teenagers. Oh, and God knows. That's a difficult age, right? I know they don't want to talk to you. I know they think you're weird. I know that everyone laughs at your jokes except for them. They always tell you you're not funny, all right? My kids always tell me I'm not funny, all right? That's fine, whatever. But maybe you look at them and say, listen, they're in a season of life right now. They've got 3 years with them, 5 years with them. This is the wall that I need to be focused on. I'm doing a great work and I can't come down. My wife and I just a couple nights ago sat out at the hotel and we just sat down and said, okay, we've got a few more years with our teenage kids. What are we going to do with them? Like, how are we going to not just build memories, how are we going to prepare them for life? How are we going to help build their character? And we started writing a list and we're coming together with a serious strategy. Quite honestly, I'm embarrassed that we haven't done it earlier. But we're coming together with a serious strategy that says, hey, we're going to take advantage of this. You know why? Because I have a 14-year-old girl who tells me all the time, Dad, I'm moving out when I'm 18. I'm going to California. And I can't blame her. We live in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Of course, she don't want to live there the rest of her life. But I have 4 years. 4 years to impact her. Right? I've got a daughter who's 12 years old. 6 more years in my house. That's all I have. So I need to think about maybe that's the wall right now. That I just say, I'm doing a great work. I can't come down. There's a lot of other things I'd like to be focused on and doing and taking up my time. But that's, I have a 7-year-old son. I'm not worried about him. He'll probably live with us 50 years and his mom will enable that kind of behavior and whatever. I just have to live with it. But for my girls, at least, that's the wall. What is it for you? Again, maybe it's a relationship that needs to be broken off. Maybe you're a college student or a teenager. What do you need to be working on right now? Maybe it's your character. Because let me tell you, who you are in life is way more important than what you can do in life.
What if he just said, you know what? Every time that I have these great opportunities to go hang out, but I know something immoral is going to be happening, something unethical is going to happen, it's going to be putting myself in a dangerous situation. What if you just said, oh, I'm on top of the ladder. And in your mind, you know, if you said it to them, they think you're weird. But in your mind, you just said, I'm doing a great work and I can't come down. I'm doing a great work. Yeah, I know. I've seen her. I know she's cute, but I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down. What is it for you? We got to bring this to a close this morning. End of the story. Bottom line, the wall was built. 52 days is all it took. A couple years ago, archaeologists actually found the Nehemiah's wall. And pretty fascinating find. A small portion of it, but pretty fascinating find. But here's what's so cool. It was done in 52 days. Now, we know that because Nehemiah put that in his journal. And that's all he said. I mean, what a dude thing to say, right? It was done. We got the wall built, 52 days. Bottom line. If it was a woman writing this, right, a diary, God knows, it would have a lot of details in there, right? The parade, it was sunny outside, we sang these songs, it was great. It's like when they have a baby, right? It's like 9 pounds, 2 ounces, 19 inches long, blonde hair, blue eyes. Here's the middle name. Here's what the name means in Latin. A guy has a baby, you never even know about it. And then you find out, and you're like, dude, did you have a baby? Yeah. Boy or girl? Yep. I mean, there's just not a lot of details, right? So, bottom line is, he says, yeah, he said the wall got built 52 days. What's so amazing about that is that it was in disrepair for 141 years. How did that happen? It happened because a guy got committed to something and he said, I'm doing a great work and I can't come down. So what is it for you? Is it a spiritual issue? Is it a relationship issue? Is it a finance issue? Is it a character issue? Is it a forgiveness issue? Is it a bitterness issue? Has bitterness eaten up your life for so long that you just say, I can't live like this anymore? What is it for you? The struggle is when you leave here today, things aren't going to change. It's not like you have more finances to work with, better relationships to work with, more strong emotions to work with. You don't have that. Hopefully you have in your mind, though, one thing that you say, this can be it. I'm going to do it. Maybe you have to spend this week praying about it and just say, God, help me identify that issue because I don't want to waste my life. And you and I, we'd never know what hangs in the balance if we can just stay on the wall long enough and say, I'm doing a great work. I cannot come down. Let me pray for you. Heavenly Father, oh, there's so many issues we could talk about today. So many areas of our life that we feel like failures. So many things that we just wish we could undo or change. Bitterness issues, character issues, relationship stuff. Just gets overwhelming. So here's what we ask. May the Holy Spirit speak to us in a powerful way that we could identify clearly the one area we should be giving attention to right now. So that week after week, month after month, we can say, hey, it's not happening quickly, but I'm making progress. God's doing a work in my life because I've decided that I'm going to stay on the wall and I'm going to do a great work and I'm not going to come down until it's finished or we've made significant progress. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.